Hello, everyone. I'm Catherine Artimas, and you're listening to Coming Clean Radio here on Transformation Talk Radio. Coming Clean is a show for all women who want to start living their lives truthfully and free themselves from anything that's kind of held them back in the past from doing what they really want. And I hope this show can be an inspiration for you, if you're listening, to take positive action in your life and, you know, start moving toward the life that you really want, the one that you really want to live. So on the show, I have in the past talked from the perspective of the one of addicts and the people who are experiencing addiction. However, we haven't yet spoken about those, the loved ones of the addict, or, you know, those people who have addicts in their lives. And from what I've learned, that these people don't have maybe as much of resources and support, yet they're very much affected in their lives from the actions of the addict. So today I'm very happy and excited to welcome my guest, Candace Plator. Is that how you pronounce your last name?
Yes, Plator. Yes.
Plator on the show. So Candace, you're a registered clinical counselor. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And you, we were just speaking earlier, you work with addicts and the loved ones of addicts in your private practice in beautiful Vancouver, Canada.
Yes, I do.
Love, that's such a beautiful area. It really is. And you're also author of two books, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, the Top 10 Survival Tips for Loving Someone with Addiction, as well as Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, the workbook.
That's right.
Yeah. So welcome to the show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here. Hello, everyone.
And in your book, you started it out by kind of sharing your story. And you mentioned before that you're actually celebrating an anniversary, a big one. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, yesterday, in fact, was my 29th year clean and sober. And it, you know,
congratulations.
Thank you. I think a lot of people would say, well, the 30th is the big one, you know, but this year really felt big to me. I was feeling very, very grateful all day.
So. Yeah. And, you know, hearing that 29 years just, I think, gives myself and probably very many people who can't even wrap their head around that many years, but gives a lot of people a lot of hope.
Well, I can totally understand that, because I never thought that I would ever get to 29 years. You know, I never did. I never thought I could ever do anything that would help the world in any kind of way. And it really, you know, to take a slogan from 12-step programs, it really is one day at a time.
Mm-hmm. One day at a time.
And
you obviously impacting a lot of people's lives. You work with those. Primarily, you said that you work with addicts, and then you also work with those who are affected by addicts, the loved ones. I wanted to ask a really quick question, because this is really fascinating to me. I haven't, we've been talking a lot about addiction and addicts, but we've never looked at this side of the story. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that there is such a lack of support and maybe resources for those people?
Wow, that's a really good question. You know, even when you think about something like an intervention, what generally happens, and a lot of people have seen the show Intervention on television too, and what generally happens in those kinds of events is that the addict is first and foremost, and the family isn't really worked with very much. You know, they get to write a letter, they're, you know, guided a little bit to do that, and then they read their letter to the addict, but that's about as far as it goes. And also, treatment centers, for the most part, don't work very much with the loved ones. And I just want to say, I'm having a bit of a throat thing this morning, so I think I'm sounding a little bit hoarse. So please bear with me.
Oh, but you sound good to me.
Do I sound okay? Okay.
But I hope it's not too painful for you.
Oh, no, it's not painful. It's just a little
okay.
So, you know, getting back to treatment centers and those kinds of programs, there are some treatment centers now that I know of that are aware that the loved ones need to have some support as well. But basically all they do is like maybe a week-long program, which is better than nothing, but it's a week-long residential program that educates them about addiction or codependency or that kind of thing. But it isn't really counseling. It isn't really about, you know, how is this manifesting in your life as the loved one? What's going on for you as the loved one? Because if you think about one person with addiction, and you think about all the people who are affected by one person's addiction, because you've got mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and grandparents and bosses and colleagues and friends and, you know, fellow students and teachers. It just goes on. And everybody's affected by this. Mm-hmm. And I think probably close to, like, I'm not a statistics person, but I would say 99.9% of people are either affected by somebody's addiction, even their own addiction, or they know somebody who is.
Mm-hmm.
And the loved ones suffer and struggle right alongside the addict. They really need help. I don't really know how to answer your exact question about why there isn't more. There definitely needs to be more. And this is why that's the choice I make, is to work with the loved ones, because they're just bereft. You know, they don't know what to do and often are doing some of the wrong things.
And that leads into the next question, like, what can people do? And you think about, like, that goes into, like, the helping and enabling, which I really found very helpful in your book. I mean, you think no one can change someone else. What can somebody do in this situation?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. In my opinion, I don't think we can change anybody else. But what we can do is we can change ourselves. And we can change what we're doing if we're affected by an addict. We can change our own behaviors, and we can educate ourselves, and so we can change our understanding. And we can learn about, you know, the difference between enabling and helping, so that we're not continuing to contribute to the addiction continuing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens a lot of the time, is when there are enabling behaviors going on, the addiction doesn't cease. It doesn't stop. Because if you think about it, you know, if you're giving money to an addict, for example, which is the classic kind of enabling behavior, you know, the addict doesn't have enough money for rent, or says he or she doesn't have enough money for food, that kind of thing, and you give them money, and you know that they're probably spending what money they have on drugs or alcohol, and you're giving them money, if you're making it comfortable for an addict to continue the addiction, to continue using, drinking, spending, whatever the addiction is, why should they stop?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've heard from people in my life who are affected by this, that it's there's just so much frustration, in the voices, because of people who are enabling, and it's like you said, why if things are being supported and they continue to live like that, why would someone stop?
Mm-hmm.
How do people know if their loved one is an addict?
Well, I think there are a lot of different kind of things that an addict changes doing. Like, if you're not sure, most people are sure, but they're in denial about it, and they don't really want to think that their loved one is an addict. And when I say an addict, I'm talking about addiction across the board. So it could be drugs, alcohol, eating disorders, internet addiction, gaming, anything. We got Pokemon now, right? That's becoming an addictive behavior for some people. There was an article, I think, in the Huffington Post that was talking about how people aren't going to work they're going Pokemon hunting.
Is that a new thing? I feel like I'm out of the loop. Okay.
It is a fairly new thing. I have one client who's doing this. So yesterday I had her explain it to me as best she could, but it's a game. It's an online game kind of thing. So, when a behavior begins to bring about difficulties in a person's life and affects their activities of daily life, that's usually when you know that somebody is an addict, that they've become addicted to whatever it is. And they start behaving differently. Certainly drugs and alcohol, it's easy to think about like an alcoholic, a person who's struggling with alcohol, getting drunk often, having terrible hangovers the next day and not able to go to work and feeling sick and, parts of their bodies, their livers, things like that become affected with drugs. Often they're out all night, they come back, they sleep all day, the mood swings are quite up and down. And that's not really who the person is that the loved one is seeing, They remember the person they love, and that's not it.
Yeah. And it's probably also very challenging when people are, functioning in this regard. Hi, everybody. We're back on Coming Clean Radio. My guest today is Candace Plator, who is talking with us about her work with addicts as well as the loved ones of addicts. So if people want to contact you and to reach out to you, what's the best way? Your website? Or are you on social media as well?
I'm on Facebook. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, all of those, all of the above. But I have a Facebook page specifically for the loved ones, and it's called Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself. So if, when I started it, there were maybe a couple of hundred people who joined up really fast and liked the page, and now there's over 5,000. So, wow. Because there are so many loved ones and so many of them have felt so alone for such a long time, it's not something that people generally like to talk about, so with people who they think might judge them and might not understand them. So I really invite you to come and lurk for a while if you want to, but feel free to come and comment and like and read some of the things that are put there. Yeah,
that sounds great. Because you're right. I mean, of course, like maybe some people who are addicted won't talk about their addiction, but even more so, people of the loved ones of addicts probably don't feel like they can talk about that with anyone. They probably, they feel alone.
They do. They feel really alone. And the reason for that, I find, I've been doing this work for about 25 years now, and I really know what loved ones feel. And a great deal of what they feel is shame about having an addict in their lives. And the shame comes from them believing that they caused their addict's addiction. Mm-hmm. And they didn't cause their addict's addiction, because the addiction is the choice of the addict. And maybe we can talk about that, as well today. But the addict is making his or her own choices. We can't choose that for anybody else. We can't make an addict become an addict.
Mm-hmm. And so that's a really good point you bring up. Brought up a lot of really good points. So that's obviously maybe a bit controversial. And because I think that many people have their own beliefs about addiction and where it comes from. In your book, Loving an Addict and Loving Yourself, you believe that people choose to go down the path of addiction. It's a choice.
Well, let me clarify, because what I'm saying is I do not believe that people deliberately choose to become addicts. I mean, I certainly didn't. I don't think anybody says, well, gee, that'll be fun. Let's be an addict. I don't think that people make that choice. So, and in fact, I really believe that for most people struggling with addiction, they didn't ever think that they'd become an addict. This is going to happen to the other guy. It's not going to happen to me. I'm not the one that's going to get addicted. I can handle it. And again, to borrow from 12 Step, they call that terminal uniqueness. that the addict mm-hmm. thinks that they're so different that it won't happen to them. And that kind of belief system can actually kill you. So it's terminal uniqueness. So I don't think that anybody initially chooses to become an addict, but I do believe that we get to a point where, you know, regardless of whether you think it's a disease, regardless of whether there's a genetic predisposition or you learned this behavior at home or, you know, there's brain involvement, which of course there is with addiction. Underneath all of that, there is a point where addicts know that there is a problem. I know this. I've been there. We know we have a problem.
Is that like when you talk to somebody when they're like, oh, well, 10 years before I quit, I had this like moment of clarity. They're like, I am, but it kind of goes away as quickly as it came.
Well, it goes away because they don't want to face it. And, you know, addiction, I consider addiction to be kind of a form of self-care. It's a twisted form of self-care that comes around and kind of bites you in the butt. And for some people, it doesn't take too long for that to happen. But it's, you know, people use addiction because they want to feel different. They want to feel better. They don't like how they feel. So I see addiction as a symptom more than anything else. It's a symptom. Sometimes it's a very devastating symptom of what's going on underneath. Why? And we need to get to what's going on underneath to be able to not be addicted anymore. But there comes a choice point when we know we have a problem. We decide, whether it's consciously or unconsciously, we decide whether we're going to stay in active addiction or we're going to move into active recovery.
Okay, so the recovery is our choice.
The choice point
like,
is whether
you can
we,
stay. Okay.
Yeah, is whether we stay in addiction or whether we go into recovery. That is the choice, and it's that. If that wasn't true, then there wouldn't be millions of people in recovery. There wouldn't be millions of people all over the world in recovery. And some of them do believe that this is a disease. I don't see it that way, but some people do believe that, and they still make the decision to not use whatever the addiction is. So, yeah.
So, in your book, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, I feel like it's a really great book for, you know, for anyone maybe who is a loved one of an addict and looking to get more information on that and maybe understand a little bit better. And you offer some really wonderful tips. You list 10.
Yeah.
Can you list some of the most, like, you'd say like maybe the most, like maybe initially the most key tips you can give?
Yeah. I think all of them are important, or I wouldn't have written all of them, but I think there are three, for me, there are three that stand out. And I'm just, I just have my book in front of me because I don't always remember the exact wording of them. But the first one that I think is really important is survival tip number 3, which says you cannot control or fix another person, so stop trying. And in fact, you and I touched on that before about, you know, you can't make an addict use and you can't make an addict stop. It just doesn't work that way. But I would like to read the quote that I have for that tip. I have quotes from other people for each tip. And this one is my favorite. It's by Robert Heinlein, who wrote Stranger in a Strange Land, if anybody knows that one. I always felt like I was a stranger in a strange land. So I like that book very much. And his quote for the tip of you can't control or fix another person, so stop trying, is never try to teach a pig to sing. It's a waste of time and it annoys the pig.
I like that one.
And really, you know, I'm not calling addicts pigs, please understand, because I'm an addict too. But you can't control anybody else. And so loved ones need to be looking at themselves and what they're doing and how they can actually move into a place of helping, being a huge help to the addict instead of enabling the addict, which is probably what's been happening.
Yeah.
Shall I go on to the next one that I think is
important? Yeah, please.
Okay, so the next one is tip number 5. And that one says, learn the difference between helping and enabling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we were talking about the shame that loved ones feel thinking that they've created this problem or that they are responsible for the addict's addiction, they've caused it. If you're a loved one listening to the show, you have not caused it. It isn't your fault. That being said, you probably have been contributing without realizing it and certainly without wanting to. You've contributed to the addiction continuing if you've been enabling your addict. So you need to learn the difference between what are enabling behaviors and what are actually helping behaviors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that's a very fine line, I'm sure, enabling and yeah, helping.
It can be a really fine line. but they are different, and it's important to know that difference. So the third one that I think is really important is survival tip number 8. And that one says, know that self-care does not equal selfish.
Mm-hmm.
Because so many loved ones don't take care of themselves. And they think, especially if they have an addict in their lives and they're catering to the addict and everything is about the addict and they just want to help the addict, which is understandable. But their own life goes on the back burner. And that's not helpful to anybody. It's mm-hmm. not helpful to the addict in your life to be constantly obsessing and, you know, doing everything for the addict. And it's not helpful to you to not be dealing with your own life. A lot of loved ones get sick with severe illnesses when they do this. There's just, you know, the self-respect, which I talk about a lot in the book. Loved ones don't often feel a lot of self-respect because they're not taking care of themselves. So that really needs to shift. And in this chapter, I talk about how to take your life back and really, you know, holistically. So looking at the different mm-hmm. parts of your life and what's important to you and how can you get that started. And yeah,
I can imagine that must be very difficult to understand, that you can be shifting it on yourself yet still love this person, you know, or still like take care of them, or not take care of them, but like help them and not enable them, but then shift it to yourself. And then I'm sure there's a lot of guilt that goes in, like, you know, mm-hmm. I'm being selfish here. I really want to talk about that a little bit more after the break.
Okay.
So we're going to take a quick break once again, and we're going to come back and continue our conversation on the work that Candace does with addicts and the loved ones of addicts. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. We're back on Coming Clean Radio. I have Candace Platter here talking about the work she does with addicts and those with addicts in their lives. So before the break, we were talking about self-care and the feelings that people might have, or the hesitancy to care for themselves, feelings maybe that it's selfish or feeling guilty. Can we talk a little bit about maybe where this feeling comes from, you know, of how that relates from their earlier life and family and being comfortable in that enabling role?
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Many, many of the loved ones that I deal with have had addiction in their growing up family, in their family of origin. And, you know, sometimes when you grow up in a family where there's addiction, you become an addict. And sometimes when you grow up in a family with addiction, you become codependent. You become a people pleaser. You take care of everybody else. And that's what many, many loved ones have done in their lives. So, like you say, it's a comfort zone for them. They know this one really well. The definition that I use for codependency, very simple. It's when you put other people's needs ahead of your own on a consistent basis. And I interchange people pleaser with codependent, So again, it's somebody who isn't really looking after their own lives, but they haven't been encouraged to do that. They don't even know that it's okay to do that in many cases. And so when they start working with me or they read my book, they start to just very, very slowly come out of their comfort zone and start to, you know, I'm working with a family now where they have a cabin for the summer. And, you know, finally they're wanting to take these are loved ones of somebody with an addiction and they want to take time at their cabin. And I'm, you know, getting up and doing the happy dance because yes, go have, you know, take some time. Maybe you won't have fun. You know, they're not quite at the point of having fun yet, but definitely they're at the point of wanting some serenity and wanting to look after themselves and not be obsessed with the addict in their lives, you know, and those are great starts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, is in your book, you talked about enmeshment, and is that the same as codependent behavior? If a couple is enmeshed with one another?
Yeah. I mean, if you're not really living your own life, but you're kind of riding around in somebody else's back pocket, you know, you're enmeshed with somebody else. And often people who do this really feel like they just don't know who they are. They don't know what their interests are. They don't know how to live their own lives. If they're not enmeshed with somebody else who quote unquote needs them, you know, they get some of their feelings of value by being needed by somebody else in these kinds of ways. And if they're not in those relationships, they flounder. They don't know what to do. And so sometimes when these relationships start to break apart, which can be very healthy but difficult, when they start to break apart, the loved ones who have been taking care of this other person, just, I don't know what to do. I don't know who to be. Who am I? Mm-hmm. And I think even though that's a very difficult place to be, and I know that because I have been there, it's really the beginning of a healthy journey. If you can stay the course, it's a beautiful beginning. Who are you? Indeed. What kind of life do you really want to have?
So is it like distraction? If you're like putting all of your focus on another person and feeling needed, is it just a distraction from focusing on your own life?
Yeah, I think it is, but I don't think that people see it that way, you know, because their need is to feel needed. When people are codependent, when somebody's a people pleaser, this is a good thing to talk about. We become people pleasers because we absolutely hate conflict. We don't want conflict. So I will do whatever you want me to do. I will twist myself into that pretzel and I'll be who you want me to be just so that you won't be angry with me or you won't be frustrated with me or, you know, and this is a very difficult way to live. And you don't get to be authentic. You don't get to be who you really are. You don't get to find out who you really are because you're just kind of pushing against that conflict that you just don't want to have. And what I've learned over the years in my own recovery, as well as in helping other people, is that when we can learn how to handle somebody else's anger toward us in healthy ways, you know, handling somebody's frustration toward us or whatever it is that they're trying to throw at us, when we can handle that in healthy ways, we are emotionally free and we don't have to people please anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we respect ourselves.
And not looking for the outside approval or
validation.
Yeah. Validation. Yeah. Yep. But it's also possible to be both an addict and a codependent, right?
Absolutely. You know, this is a very good point. A lot of addicts wear two hats and a lot of loved ones wear two hats. You know, sometimes a loved one is also somebody who at 5 o'clock when they start making dinner, they're having a few glasses of wine. just to get away from the feelings of everything that's been happening. And people who are already in addiction are, you know, the thing about addiction is that it really does create a lot of self-absorption. So once you really get entrenched into an addiction, into an addictive behavior, you don't really care that much about anybody else. But people-pleasing and codependency is also, I think, an addictive behavior. You do it so that you don't have to face your own stuff. And so sometimes loved ones, even with all they do, all they give to somebody else, they're really actually meeting their own needs. And this is really hard for a loved one to wrap their heads around.
You know? And it's probably hard to get out to break that pattern if you're very comfortable, quote unquote, like as you said in the book.
But here's the thing. If you're a loved one and you want your addict to change, you want your addict to come out of his or her comfort zone, you're also going to need to be willing to come out of yours, and you recover together. And this is why I work with families. I work predominantly with families now. I don't work with just addicts or just loved ones, because this is a family condition, and everybody is affected in the family. Everybody is, whether they think they are or not. And so everybody needs to heal. And I'm so passionate about helping families heal from addiction, because it absolutely is possible. And I get some really good results.
And in your book, you had, you posed the question, like the magic question, to, those loved ones, right? It was like, what is the magic question?
The magic question in psychology, the magic question is, how would your life be different? What would your life be like if you didn't have this situation in it? Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, the responses that I get, because some people will say, oh, it would be wonderful, you know, if the addict I love would stop and become the person that they used to be. And, you know, my life would be totally different. It would be wonderful. It would be fantastic. That's one response. And the other response is, I'm not sure what I would do with myself, which I think is probably closer to the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's like, they don't even know, they're so wrapped up in the codependent, or, you know, the people pleasing, that they don't even know if this wasn't the way, what they would even do.
Yeah. And I want to just say one other thing about people pleasing. Because in some cases, you know, people, loved ones are afraid of the addicts in their lives with good reason. And you know, there are addicts who have been allowed to get away with being rageful, who, you know, punch holes in walls, who hit or push their family members, who, you know, who are allowed to do these kinds of behaviors, and there aren't any consequences. If there aren't consequences, behaviors don't change. That's, you know, if nothing changes, nothing changes, right? But if you have an addict in your life who really could be physically dangerous to you or somebody else that you love, you need to get some help with that. And it's totally understandable why you'd want to avoid conflict. Mm-hmm. But continuing to avoid the conflict is not the answer.
All right. Mm-hmm.
So it's understandable, but it's not healthy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're going to take another break. And when we come back, we're going to further discussion and also talk about some alternatives in recovery. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Coming Clean Radio. I'm your host, Catherine Artimas. I'm speaking today with Candace Plator and the work she does with addicts and those with addicts in their lives. So we've been talking about a lot about the work you've done, or the work that you do. And you are located in Canada. However, you work with people all, like, internationally. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. So you work via Skype.
I work on Skype and I work on the phone, and I have I currently have clients in Australia and the United States and certainly in Canada. And I have a family in England as well that I'm working with. So it doesn't matter where you are. If you'd like to contact me, and if you'd like some help for your family, I've actually developed a family treatment program that I offer to families, where I work with the whole entire unit, the whole family. And we get, usually the addict isn't quite ready in the beginning, but we do what we can to get the addict ready. And in the meantime, I'm working with the loved ones. And sometimes the addict is ready to come, and that's even better. That's wonderful. So a lot of changes can happen either way. And I have a year-long program and I have a six-month program. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if someone's listening and is interested in learning more, what should they go to your website and contact you there?
Yeah, there's a contact sheet that they can fill out there, or they can just email me at candace@candaceplatter.com. Just make sure you're spelling both of my names right, because mm-hmm. if you don't, I won't get it.
And CandacePlatter.com is also on the Transformation Talk Radio page. So if you go to this show and then you go to this episode, your information will be there for them to find.
Wonderful. Yeah, if you want to contact me that way, and then we can arrange to have a free consultation and see what your needs are and how I could help.
Great. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So in addition to working with those with addicts in their lives, you do work with addicts, and you work with an alternative recovery model. Is that right?
I do when I have an addict as a client who says to me, and this has happened many times over the years, who says, I hate 12-step programs, I'm not going to go to them. You know, I really understand that. And I started out in 12-step programs 29 years ago because there weren't any other programs available to me. And it really saved my life, quite literally, because I was suicidal at the bottom where I was. There are some really good things about 12-step programs. So it's not that I'm saying, you know, that I don't like them. It's not a question of whether I like them or not. I think there are some really good things like sponsorship and the fellowship and like-minded people, but, a lot of people don't like them. And there are a few reasons for that. You know, they talk about the God thing, capital G, the God thing. God is mentioned several times in the steps. People who have been in families where there have been, you know, problems with religion, maybe shame about religion, don't like that. They've become more spiritual than religion, and they don't like the wording or God as we understand him. So for some people, it's too patriarchal. There's also the idea in 12-step programs that if you don't work the steps exactly the way they're written, exactly the way everybody tells you to, that you're not willing to do whatever it takes to be in recovery. And that's just not the case a lot of the time. So I'm really happy that there have been some different programs that have come up during the years that I've been clean and sober. I'm very gratified to see that.
Do you find that when you said people are saying I don't want to do 12-step, is that more and more often that you're hearing this from your clients?
Well, I think it probably is. It's not like I hear that all the time, but I think, you know, there are groups of people, like often women don't like the 12 steps, the wording of the hymn and, you know, the patriarchal flavor of it. People mm-hmm. of color don't always like it. The gay community doesn't always like it. But I'm not saying that the 12 steps can't work for those people. Please don't misunderstand me. because it can work for anybody for whom it is a fit. It's just not a fit for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so we need to have other programs.
Yeah. And it's also just nice, whatever you choose, just to know that you do have an option, that you have several options in front of you to choose what's best for you.
Exactly. Exactly. And one of the ones that I really like is the 16 steps. And that's, that was created by a woman named Charlotte Castle. That's K-A-S-L. The 16 steps are not just the 12 steps and four more added on. The 16 steps are a whole different set of steps. And she was in the 12-step programs and not liking it much when she decided that she was going to change the wording of the steps, which I think is very courageous of her to do. Mm-hmm. I think it was frowned upon, especially years ago when she came up with this. But the 16 steps are much more inclusive and spiritual rather than religious in tone. And, you know, they don't talk about how you're powerless. They actually talk about how you do have the power to take charge of your life. You have the power, you know, if you choose to do it that way. So it's just a very different set of steps. If you want to look it up, it's on my website. On the free articles page, there's an article about the difference between the 12 steps and 16 steps. So that's one alternative.
Mm-hmm. And that's when you've used that with, you said that you've had experience in a group with other women and with maybe clients, perhaps. Has it been well received?
It's been well received, yeah. I ran a group for a number of years in Vancouver's downtown East Side area, which is the lowest income area in all of Canada. It's where you have per capita the most addicts and alcoholics. And I was there for 16 years as an addictions counselor. So while I was there, I ran a 16-step group. As soon as I saw these steps, as soon as they came out, it was like love at first sight for me. And there were women who came to my group week after week after week, and it was so empowering. It was just such an empowering set of steps that we just kept doing it.
I have to say, when I've come across them, I also, it was kind of like love at first sight. I was a bit just like intrigued. I was like, whoa, this, you know, like, that's great. You know, like just the wording, it just... Yeah. Some people, it will speak to some people, you know, and they'll be like, yeah, that's really something I could do.
I think it's really worth looking it up. It's not just for women. I mean, men can use it. And when I have clients who don't want to go to 12-step programs, what I often do is I copy the steps. We get the workbook that Charlotte Castle wrote. It's called Yes, You Can. And we go through the 16 steps together. So it can be done one-to-one that way as well. And that's the workbook, Yes, You Can, is a great tool to have to if you want to start your own group. Because she tells you everything you need to do. And she's got writings and readings about this, each step, and even templates for flyers that you can use. I mean, it's a wonderful book, Yes, You Can.
Wow. Thank you for that. I'm going to look into that.
Yeah. I'm hoping more of them will spring up, you know.
Well, thank you so much for coming on to the show and sharing like your so much knowledge about this area and all of your insight. And the thank you, you know, for the important work that you do. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to invite, I definitely want to have you on again if you'll come on.
I would love to come back. Yep.
Yeah. It was so great talking with you, and I'm sad that the show is over now.
Fast.
I want to thank all of you out there for tuning in to Coming Clean. Please join me every Tuesday at 12 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Central, and 9 a.m. Pacific time. You can visit to learn more about Candace. You can go to CandacePlateau.com and her website, and also Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself on Facebook. And my website is katherinemoss.com. So have a great week, and we'll see you back here next time. Thank you.